Morning. Welcome to the special session, special committee on revenue. Yesterday we heard Senate Bill 1022. We have an amendment in concept on Senate Bill 1022. We adopted the amendment in concept on Senate Bill 22. What I was handed this morning was, in fact, the LC version of the Senate Amendment, so it's Senate Amendment 1022-1. We have not filed that bill yet, so the chairman's intention is to bring that bill back and have the committee review the amendments as they were drafted, since we acted yesterday without a draft. And we will consider that, reconsider that, name a carrier, and take appropriate action. However, that will not be this morning. This morning we'll continue our work on Senate Bill 1021. Where we left off yesterday was with having heard testimony from a couple of different organizations that offered testimony both from the employer and the employee perspective. We have this morning before us an opportunity to hear from folks from the PERS board and executive director. So if we could go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1021, we'll call forward Mr. Voitko, the executive director, and others that he may have in attendance to speak to the proposal, Senate Bill 1021, from the PERS board's perspective. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The first thing I have to clarify is I'm not speaking necessarily on behalf of the board. The PERS board has not yet made a decision on mortality tables under the current statutory instruction that you've given.
So, Mr. Voitko, you'd be speaking in your own name, and you have to announce it for the record.
Okay. I'm James Voitko, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon's Public Employees Retirement System.
Thank you. Proceed.
As I mentioned, Mr. Chair, members of the board, the PERS board has not yet made a decision on mortality table policy under the current statutory direction that we have received from you and your colleagues, nor has it taken a position on this draft legislation, so I will not be taking a position on the legislation per se. You have asked us to review 1021, the mortality table issue, provide information to you on it, and we're prepared to do so. I have just a couple of brief pages of comments that I can walk through. I believe those have been distributed to the committee. And we also have a summary that we've used on the mortality table question with the PERS board so that you can see how the PERS board has tried to grapple with this very difficult and knotty issue. I'll proceed as you direct.
Mr. Wick, if you could take us through the comments that have been distributed to the committee. And have these also been made available for the public?
That's it, but I don't think I have a copy of it.
Senator Crowe needs a copy if there's extra comments.
Maybe thank you if you can connect that.
Thank you.
That's not wrong.
And are there copies available for the public? Thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Chair Farioli and members of the committee. The first thing I would say is that these comments are best supplemented by those that were provided in a letter, a series of letters that we have been asked to produce for your colleague, Senator Nelson, the most recent one being on the mortality table question. I believe that letter and its attachments have also been provided to committee staff and for you.
They have been distributed.
With respect to SB 1021, I'd like to mention a few things that it doesn't do, and I mention these because these are issues that we have been wrestling with at the board level, the staff level, and are, in fact, are currently in litigation over to the extent that they've troubled the board, troubled the staff, and are subject to litigation. We would offer them up as consideration for any attempt to clarify what the legislature's policy is meant to, policy message to us is meant to be with respect to mortality tables. In that respect, 1021 does not define what the benefit is under money match, and there is a significant dispute in the statute as to what the benefit really is. Since that is an issue and a vagueness in the statute, we would offer it to your consideration as to whether or not a complete and comprehensive statement of policy on mortality tables that does not address this issue is what you want to do. The second is that it does not define key terms that actually drive benefit calculations that use the mortality tables, most particularly those that are required to be actuarially equivalent. This is an undefined term in statute. Again, it is has troubled the board and the staff and is currently a matter for a litigation just two blocks away as we speak. The third is it does not put a policy directive to us on mortality tables or to the board, except by indirectly via the prescription of a particular mechanism. And again, we would mention that this is something that is a departure, for example, from what the Senate did in the last regular session with SB 134, where there was a statement of policy that came along with the prescriptions. It doesn't clarify the general policy the board is to follow if we subsequently discover a matter that's up in the air right at the moment. We subsequently discover that IRS rules require some modification of the process by which mortality table changes need to be implemented. And this is to ensure that we follow your statutory instruction, that we conform with whatever IRS requirements are necessary to preserve our qualified plan status. Instead, what it does is that it redundantly codifies a particular mechanism for addressing accrued benefit. At this point, we're not sure that the IRS requirement of accrued benefit actually applies to a governmental plan like PERS. And even if it does, we're not sure how it applies and would be programmatically executed under Money Match. In some respects, by specifying a particular mechanism, codifying it in statute, we race ahead of whatever, if anything, the IRS might require in this area. And also, by not integrating this change with existing statutory language like actuarially equivalent or a definition of what the benefit is under Money Match, it adds a layer to the statute that is not well connected to the other directives and definitional terms that are in the statute. And this, again, is something that we have been chided for in current litigation with respect to the state of the statute. I would offer for your consideration that some of the comments in our letter to Senator Nelson address the issue of connections between current statutory language and the possible avenues for executing whatever policy you determine is appropriate in the mortality table area.
Mr. Chair. Senator Truro has a question.
We could, in a bill like 1021, have defined the benefit under Money Match and given definitions for actuarially equivalent and so forth. If we had done that in the bill, would it have made the bill a better bill?
Well, Chair Farioli, Senator Truro, it would have done two things, and it depends, of course, on what exactly you said, but it would, one, connect this piece of legislation to existing statutory directives, which in terms of clarification of instruction to us and to our board is very helpful. The second thing is that, and you ought to consult with legislative counsel on this question, over all changes in the PERS statute is the question of whether or not contract rights is engaged and therefore makes whatever elements that are in the statute perpetual in nature. Mm-hmm. To the extent that new elements are laid on top of old ones but not connected, it is easier for a court to look at it and say, this is brand new. Mm-hmm. To the extent that the legislature makes changes and clarifies existing terms in the statute, and the statute is the contract, then it seems to me that, and again, I'm not a lawyer, you should consult with your own attorneys, that the odds of a court saying that the legislature is clarifying what is in the contract as opposed to adding new elements, it raises the defensibility of whatever change you might feel is appropriate in subsequent litigation. So it has two beneficial effects, beneficial if you put value in it.
Question, Senator.
I guess on the point of clarification, respect to definitions of terms like actuarially equivalent, does the board have general rulemaking authority?
The board does have general rulemaking
authority. Have they ever defined these terms?
Only indirectly, in the sense that in 1998 they adopted a mortality table policy but I don't recall that, other than in practice, there is a definition in our published rules, in our administrative rules, that specifically defines actuarial equivalent. I'm going to turn to my staff. We're not aware of any.
Right. Have these issues ever been brought before the legislature before, a lack of actual definition of these kinds of terms?
I'm hard-pressed, being in the job only 2 years, my history goes back so, so shallowly that I can't respond very well to your question, Senator Minna.
It just seems with all the lawyers out there, you'd expect that somebody would have thought of it.
Somebody has thought of it, and I think that's why we're in litigation right now.
Yeah. I thought maybe one of our lawyers should have thought of it.
Colleagues, the PERS section in Oregon Revised Statutes, I think, is tens of thousands of pages of words, and multiple pages, I think over 70. The 1021, the bill before, two pages. And I think its intent is to deal with the issue of the actuarial tables. And there is even some disagreement about what the bill does, just in these two pages. But I think the point here that I'm hearing, and I'll ask Mr. Voice if that isn't the objective, there is much in PERS that, in the existing statutes, that could benefit from a visitation on policy questions by this legislature. And I think that's the list of things that the bill doesn't do, that Mr. Voitko was just pointing out, it would be helpful if we had that in statute. So I'm going to ask if you could make margin notes on these three pages that Mr. Voitko has brought. Let us get through this presentation and then come back, because if these suggestions are necessary to make adjustments in the actuarial tables and the operation of PERS, I think we're going to be looking at a much more comprehensive piece of legislation than 1021. Is that...
Chair Ferrioli, I couldn't agree with you more. That was obviously the thrust of my comment, the desire for clarification so that our board understands exactly what the legislature is asking it to do. And I would say, too, that in the letter to Senator Nelson, we, for your consideration, put forward a different approach to get to the same kinds of policy questions or issues that are raised in 1021, but via the definitions as opposed to via the mechanisms. 1021 takes a mechanistic approach to it and gets to policy. The discussion in Senator Nelson's letter takes a definitional and policy question or policy statement approach to get to the policy matter at hand. So it's a fundamentally different approach, I think. It's not for us to say which one you desire, you choose, but I think it's important to recognize that they are two different approaches.
Oh, I think so, and I guess... Mr. Voitko, what we have, I think, is a parlance that most people will interpret differently. We have a whole bunch of terms that people are not clear about. And in order for us to make these sort of policy discussions, I can see the approach that the majority leader took in asking these questions. What do these words mean? How are they interpreted? But in fact, that those are the policy questions that you brought before us today. You left off with the IRS connection and the directive to maintain qualified plan status. Let's proceed from there.
I would move on then, Chair Ferrioli, to a question. You raised the issue a moment before that people are not in total agreement as to what the legislation might do. I would relate to you with respect to my comment in the written testimony of what we cannot easily ascertain and would call to your question, call to your attention. We had a quick staff meeting today to go over this bill and say, how would we do it if we had to do it? Now, admittedly, we had 50 minutes to think about it, but we could not come to an easy consensus over what these words meant, and particularly the issue of the reference to the use of tables in effect at the time the member joins the system. We obviously, as we went around the table, could not figure out exactly why that was there, what it did, and what it was meant to serve. And my only comment is that since billions of dollars and a very long-term contract is at stake, 50 years, we write 50-year contracts every day with new employees, and thousands of our members make retirement decisions and their financial outcomes swing on these few words, we would urge that every possible attempt be made to erase even the smallest ambiguities wherever possible and desirable in your view. ambiguities create difficulties for our board in understanding what your directive is, and they lead us to litigation, because it only takes one of our 294,000 members or one of our 867 employers to disagree with the definition of a term that's unclear, and we end up in court. One of the things that is not addressed that has been discussed at length over the much of the last decade is whether or not the issue of contract rights appends to changes to the contract or additions or clarifications to the contract. It's interesting to note that 1021 is silent on this issue. It may be by desire, but we were not sure as we went over the bill whether or not, after all this discussion, the legislature decided that it wanted the current uncertainty over contract rights to continue with additional revisions to the statute, or whether it wanted to take a different tack. Again, not our decision to make, but it was one of the issues, again, that was up in the air. There was some discussion yesterday, Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee, about the PERS board's actions and considerations. And Senator Dukes wanted to know if there was a simple diagram that sort of brought this mass of factors and data together. In fact, I have tried to arrange for us to have that available to you. There are some different points in 1021 than those that have been considered by the board or primarily considered by the board, and I wanted to go over those. 1021 creates a window for rapid acceleration of retirements and what appears to be a pretty strong incentive for public employees to jump through it, regardless of other factors that they might normally consider in deciding this life, career, financial decision. The board chose to explicitly consider that, and as you can see there, it talks about on the left-hand side is a row, a column rather, and the second item down is the clustering or acceleration of retirements. So with respect to this issue, we recommended to the board, and the board agreed, that this was something that we wanted to at least take cognizance of. Again, that doesn't mean that you should. we do know that that if that's true, and if our understanding of the bill is correct, then all of these retirements would be annuitized into payment streams to retirees under the old 78 tables, the vast, vast majority of them. Again, that may be an objective that you seek to do, but it's somewhat at odds with the direction that the bill is taking overall. The drain of highly experienced public servants would have consequences that are unpredictable in terms of the maintenance, productivity, and quality of public services. I can only speak to that as the manager of a tiny agency. The Department of Administrative Services is or your own experience is a far more a far vaster set of experience and authority to seek on this question, but I would be remiss if I didn't say it was something that concerned me with respect to our small group of 200 people. I would also say, and I say in the letter to Senator Nelson, that while administrative consequences should always take a back seat to policy directives from the legislature, the potential for large surges in retirements is not inconsequential to our ability to process them in a timely and accurate fashion. On this topic, in the materials that I've given you that are attached to Senator Nelson's letter, you'll see a longer discussion of it. I would say that because of the introduction of 1021, it is the sense of our staff that the bell has already been rung on this issue, and that even if the legislature takes no action on mortality table policy, we anticipate at the staff level that there will be some reaction in the membership base, and we will see a surge in retirements of some magnitude. In fact, we're already experiencing that. We're experiencing the largest July 1st surge of retirements since the late 1990s, and have had to make, as Dallas Wyand told you yesterday, some significant relocations of people and reductions of other services in order to meet the transactions that have landed on our desks, even prior to the introduction of 1021. The final thing is that a question was raised yesterday about whether or not the approach taken in 1021 was similar or different to any of the approaches that were considered by the board. The answer is yes, it is closest to what we would call the immediate implementation option. And it is dissimilar to both the, what the chairman described yesterday as the incremental approach, what we call the five-year wear away, although the 5 years is something that can be dialed to one or two or three or seven or ten, and also to the multiple segment approach, which has been forwarded to the board and considered by them, in fact, considered favorably by one of the subcommittees of the board, during the debate over these issues. The board as itself, as a whole, has not yet decided over what method to pursue if it, it has to go on its own. But I would say that based on the deliberation of the board, the two contenders are the incremental approach as the chairman described it yesterday. Whether or not it's 5 years or some other period of transition time, that remains to be seen. And the multiple segment approach, which also, I believe is a contender at the full board level. The full board, however, has not taken a vote, so I cannot speak to where the board is heading on this. But I would say that the attachments to our letter to Senator Nelson, and, the chart that I have in front of you today, indicate that the board considered five policy objectives when it looked at this question. The first one, does the option eventually move the entire retirement system to full, complete implementation of modern tables at some point, whether it's 3 years, 5 years, 7 years? Does it get us there completely at some definite point in time? The second, as I mentioned earlier, does the option avoid undue acceleration of retirement decisions, that is, the complete overriding of other factors that members might consider in deciding when and how to retire? The third is, does the option create large administrative burdens and add additional complexity on top of a system that is already among the most complex, certainly, I've ever seen? The fourth, would the option meet IRS requirements? And the fifth, what level of litigation loss risk does the option create versus the policy benefits that are considered here? So this one chart really answers the questions, or at least they've been accepted as the answers by the board, for those questions which are in the first column on the left that I just went through, and for the four approaches that were really considered, which is do nothing, stay with the current approach, immediate implementation, a transition or incremental approach of some number of years, and the multiple segment approach. I'll stop there, and I'm prepared to answer any questions that I can or help you in any way, and if I can't answer your question today, I will work hard to find the answer for you.
Thank you. Senator Deeks has a question, and Senator Trump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director, I'm confused on one, and so maybe I misunderstood yesterday when people were presenting things. On your chart, fully implemented latest mortality tables under multiple segment, you have no, and then has requires perpetual use of old tables. I thought that the segmented approach was bringing in the new tables, sort of merging things, so that over a period of time there was use of the new tables. I can't recall that I was convinced that they were fully implemented, but it led me to believe that they weren't going to continually, perpetual use of old tables was not correct.
Chair Farioli, Senator Deeks, the approach would take, say, for example, a 30-year career employee, and say there were three 10-year segments where there were different mortality tables in question. When we retired the person at the end of 30 years, a third of their retirement would be calculated on one that was 20 or 30 years old, depending on when it was in place. A third of their retirement would be calculated on one that was 10 or 20 years old. And the most recent segment would affect a third of their retirement. This is a highly simplified example, but the multiple segment approach carries forward, has the benefit of introducing new modern mortality tables for service segments as you go forward, or in the money match system, account increments. But always its downfall, or downside, I should say, is that it always drags with it old tables as part of the calculation. And we look at it as the total retirement calculation, how much of it is driven by current tables and by old tables. And under the multiple segment approach, our best understanding of it is, and we've looked at it very intensively, is that it would always contain a proportion of the benefit calculated under outdated tables.
So would it be more accurate to say perpetual use of old tables and new tables, so that you're going to...
I think I think that's a fair revision, is that there would always be some slice under money match, because money match weights heavily money that was put in the account early on. It might not be as quite as neat as a third, a third, a third. It might be 50, 30, 20, but it depends, again, on the circumstances. I think you're right. There will always be another way to look at it is that there would always be a portion of the retirement account that would be calculated on modern tables.
Okay. I have one other question, Mr. Chair.
Can
your system handle any of this?
It is my considered opinion that our system can't handle the current statute, the current program.
Can't
okay. Effectively, productively, and accurately transact the retirement business.
Okay.
Under the current statute, we would simply add to our difficulties, and we would do the best we can. But we have severe problems. They're not rooted in the mortality table question per se.
No.
They are pervasive throughout the statutory instructions that, as the chairman pointed out, run to 64,000 words and 76 pages.
And I don't mean any disrespect on this, but we'll do the best we can isn't good enough. And I know that may be the best you can give me at the moment, but I need to know more. My biggest fear with PERS is that one day the system is going to collapse. And I think with what we have today, we have a good chance that that won't happen soon, and we're working to make improvements and are making improvements so that it may never happen, but I know that your computer situation is far less than ideal, and some of these would require considerable things to the computer, and I do remember you telling us once a couple of years ago that we were fine as long as we didn't make any changes, add anything to the system. So that's something that I have a great concern about. And I want, if we're going to go out and tell the people by passing a law that this is what we're doing, I want to make sure we can do it.
Well, Chair Farioli, Senator Dukes, I think I understand the fear, because I have it as well, of a systemic collapse. But I think I think that the odds of that are very low. However, what happens the more worrisome is that as we add complexity to the system, what we do is we trade off accuracy, timeliness, and productivity, all of which are extremely important, in order to cope with complexity. We can cope with these things. The cost will be resources, higher risk of inaccurate transactions, and we're struggling mightily to try to lower our error rate, which is too high. But again, I said earlier to the chairman that we don't want to put administrative issues in front of multi-billion dollar policy questions that you're considering, because that would be extraordinarily parochial on our part, and it just wouldn't be appropriate.
Okay.
Senator Truro.
If we follow the just don't do anything now approach, what are the problems connected with that?
The problems of staying with the current approach,
yeah.
I think that it depends on what policy objectives you care about. If you believe that it is important for the system to use the most accurate knowledge that we can glean about the circumstances in which we do transactions, mm-hmm. retirement transactions, then the gap, which is now approximately 24 years in terms of longer, the period of time that lifespans have grown longer, will grow bigger and bigger. Part of the knotty problem that the board has had is that the gap has grown large enough mm-hmm. that there is substantial amounts of, you can call them liabilities or you can call them payment obligations, depending on your perspective, but that number will grow over time, provided that lifespans continue to increase, and there's every reason to think that they will. So if the problem isn't addressed now and you believe that accurate mortality tables are, in the end, where the legislature would like to direct us, the gap will grow larger and larger over time.
Well, it is true that the board has the authority to remedy this problem on its own motion, right?
We believe that, that the board, Senator Tro, can act on this issue and in fact has a long-running process in place to do so.
But the board has not, so, and, I don't know that it is intending to, in the near future. Perhaps it is, I don't know. You can tell me that. But will it be useful, would it be a positive thing to do for the legislature to make a decision between these three formulas that are in front of us, and give the board instructions to do something?
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Tro, I would answer that question the same way I answered questions that were posed to me about SB 134, and that is, I know from listening to the board for the last 2 years that they struggle terribly with either conflicting terms in the statute, undefined terms, or places where the statute is silent. So to the extent that the legislature, as it did with respect to deficits in Tier 1, can give more explicit direction in places where the statute is silent, I believe the board would appreciate that. What policy is in those directions is your purview, not ours. So with respect to the choices here, or some other choice, you know, we would say if the instructions that we could get would be clear and unambiguous, that in itself would be a help.
Our problem with the board's neutrality or your neutrality is that we're really not the experts in all of this. And if we give you policy that doesn't make any sense, it's going to compound and make your life much more difficult. And don't we have the right to ask you what do you think would be the best policy and to help us formulate that?
You do have the right, Senator Tro, obviously, and I believe my board would instruct me to respond. I would like to have an opportunity to consult with them because the board is the policy-making arm of the PERS system. And so I don't want to get out ahead of my board, and those questions have not been posed directly to my board. And I'm respectful of their prerogatives, as I'm respectful of yours. But I believe that they may be prepared to answer those questions. I will say that in their goals and objectives statement, they specifically eschewed or stepped back from any questions that involve the setting of benefits or the distribution of funding responsibilities, seeing that as a purview of the legislature, and I believe and I adhere to that policy as well. To the extent that we can help you with consequences, we have not hesitated to step forward. If you want to pose, is this policy better than that policy question, I certainly would immediately take those back to the board.
It seems like that we're in a situation where if we take action, we risk complicating your lives and making the whole problem difficult for you and maybe making mistakes. If we don't do anything, we're going to look bad, I suppose, and maybe we need to do some things. But what I think we need someplace is the kind of expertise that allows us to do what makes sense for the system, to make it better rather than to complicate it and make it worse.
Well, Chair Ferrioli, Senator Tro, to the extent that you can even outline the general policy objectives that you would like the system to pursue, we would work as hard as possible to bring back what we thought were reasonable ways to get there. This is very similar to the discussion that we had with the Senate leadership about their policy desire not to have Tier 1 leave behind deficits for the system as a whole. Once that policy objective was given to us, so that we knew that it was the legislature's or at least the sponsors of the bill, as opposed to us picking an objective for the legislature, which we're very reluctant to do, then we got to work with committee staff and worked hard to try to find a way to achieve the committee's objective. As I look at 1021, the authors of the bill seem to have the policy objective of mind of getting to modern mortality tables, albeit quicker than some of the schemes that you see on the board here today. The incremental approach, or what we call the wear-away, has the advantage of you can dial how fast you want to get there. And the trade-off is the slower you get there, the less change that you have in the actuarial liabilities of the system. The faster you get there, the more change you have, and it similarly affects all of the objectives on the right. But it is the only one that has a parameter that is subjective and is totally in control of the author of the proposal.
Senator Fisher has a question, and then Senator Mills.
Yeah, I was, thanks, Mr. Chair. I was sitting here wondering, I don't have a problem with amending bills, but the time factor, how long it would take if you try to get board approval and all this kind of thing, how long is the time frame that we're looking at?
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Fisher, it's difficult to say. My board is scattered all over the state, and they meet once a month face-to-face. They do meet telephonically under emergency situations. And I also can't guarantee that they would agree to propose policy advice directly to you. I can only tell you that I would take that question to them, and I would do so as quickly as possible. It's conceivable we could have an answer within 48 hours if that is the board's desire.
If Senator Fisher has had his question answered, then to Senator Menace.
Yes. Could you go over that part of your testimony about not being able to manage the system thing? I want to get some clarification on that, because that's kind of a surprise to me. So.
Well, Chair Ferrioli, Senator Minnis, I didn't say we couldn't manage the system. We are managing the system, and in fact, we get many more transactions right than we make errors on. And we do meet the statutory deadlines, and we do provide excellent advice and service to our members. Particularly given the complex information that we have to work with our members on. But is it at the standards that we, or I believe our board, ought to be in terms of accuracy, productivity, what's achievable given modern tools? The answer is no. And that's my opinion. I believe it's also the board's as well. Otherwise, they wouldn't have regularly and almost monotonously approved our approaches to the legislature to try to approve our toolkit. And what we are most concerned about is as the system is already very complex, it grows in complexity as the legislature tries to conform it to what it believes are the best pension policies for the state. But because relatively nothing has been ever sunset, and may not be able to be sunset if the very broad and powerful theories of contract rights turn out to be true. We have, as Judge Lipscomb described it, a house in which we continue to put additions on in a manner that we end up with a lot of property to tend to at the end of the day. So as we look at that and we look at the demographics that we face, the baby boomer retirements and their replacement hires, we've carefully projected our system membership in terms of retirees as well as new members joining the system, and we see enormous amount of growth in the system over the next 15 to 20 years, financially, membership-wise, transactional.
Follow-up, Senator?
And, sir, my statement wasn't intended to indict you in any way. I mean, it just seems to me we have a board that I'm sure they're all professional individuals, and they're very dedicated to the purpose. But they meet once a month and sometimes by telephone. This situation has been characterized in the press and among other members here as a crisis. And it would appear to me that given that circumstance and your comments about the complexity of managing this system, that perhaps there ought to be more time and energy put into trying to rectify what we know are our problems. But the ultimate question I want to ask you is, do you think it would be prudent to at some point kind of freeze things in time and go back and think of other ways to kind of backfill some of the problem holes. In other words, we've got these mortality tables that are, the time is getting longer and longer in terms of life expectancy, so we've got a big deficit hole that's potentially being, theoretically being filled out there. At some point, we have to legally freeze that in time, and then, which is why I guess I'm advocating that at some point, if we change the mortality tables, we do it on the passage of the date of the bill kind of thing, so that whatever pre-existed in terms of benefits would stand for the employees. It doesn't give you the big financial benefit. But then maybe look at other investment strategies or other kinds of ways of managing the portfolio that might help backfill some of those existing holes. Because, the other side of this whole equation is, how well are we managing the system? Is the Oregon Investment Council doing well? Are we over-invested in stocks? Do we have other strategies that they're employing? Have they employed all, the appropriate strategies? I'm sitting here wondering whether or not they're buying annuity policies for any of these people, and is that possible? Some of the corporate world out there buying life insurance policies on their own people, employees. Maybe government ought to think about that. I don't know.
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Minnis, I'm overwhelmed by the sheer number of questions.
Well, I say this kind of stuff because I'm not going to fix this thing in one question or series of questions, but it appears to me that there is a problem, there is a crisis, and both those people who are managing the system, running the system, us as stewards of the system, and those participants, particularly the unions or other beneficiaries, have an interest in success of this program. We don't want this to turn into a publicly held Enron.
I'd like to make a couple comments, Senator Minnis. First of all, with respect to the board, it does meet in a full meeting once a month. Its committees will meet during the month sometime, depending on the issues at hand, and they do emergency telephonic meetings. I want to say on their behalf, this is an extremely hardworking board. Meetings in old times, I was told before my arrival, used to start at 9 and end at 11. Well, now they start at 8:30, and they have gone as late as 5 o'clock. And we've even had emergency evening meetings that have lasted till 9 or 10 o'clock. If you look at the history, for example, of the board's wrestling with the mortality table question, I think any reasonable person would believe that would come to the conclusion that this board has worked extremely hard to try to get their arms around a difficult issue, which I think you now appreciate how difficult it is. I would also say that your comment about it won't give us the savings that we seek. None of this analysis is predicated on trying to engineer a particular benefit or a particular reduction in liabilities. If you read the attachment to Senator Nelson's letter, we asked only the questions associated with the first column.
Excuse me, don't mind for interrupting. I understand your need to be careful in what you say here, but my observation as a legislator is that you guys are steering a potential Titanic here. I mean, you don't have to comment on that. But from my perspective, it requires some certified smart people, I think like Senator Trove. I'm talking not him in particular.
And you weren't referring to Senator Trove. I'm referring to the certified smart people to whom he referred.
On this issue, I'm not sure.
I'm just saying that it really takes, rather than you sitting there trying to defend yourself or not saying the wrong thing so that it's going to be cited somewhere in some litigious environment, and I understand the need to perhaps do that. I can mouth off as much as I want for the most part. But it seems to me that if the system is in crisis, if there are legitimate problems, then all of the stakeholders have an interest in trying to resolve those issues, and that the legislature's role here may very well be to facilitate bringing those parties together and trying to find some resolution here. So.
Well, Senator Minnis, I would say that, as you are aware, there are two formal and one informal groups currently reviewing pension policy for the state. The first one is the Governor's Task Force, which has been named, and we will be working closely with. And I anticipate that the range of the issues that they will look into is as broad and broader than the questions that you raised in your comments. The second is that the House Speaker has set a task force, which has already met once. The leadership of that task force has come to visit PERS. They've requested work group information, which we are providing. And I think that the range of questions that they are likely to ask are as broad or broader than the questions you just raised. There are a group of senators led by Senator Nelson who have posed for us a long list. The letter that I distributed to you is one of the questions posed, a long list of very thoughtful questions about those kinds of issues. And while we will, because we believe it's not our prerogative, to tell you what pension policy ought to be for the state, we will compare and contrast and show you the consequences of one pension policy versus another. And I think the letter that you have on mortality policy, for example, is exactly the kind of analysis, the way that we know under our current regime, that is what our charter is, that we can help you in this difficult area.
The testimony that we've had earlier from the other interested parties did produce some agreements, which I think would benefit us. Just to reiterate here, both the employers and the employees acknowledge that new tables are necessary. At least that's what I heard in testimony. They both acknowledge that the health of the system is just as critical to employers as it is to the beneficiaries of the program, that it's a necessary part of the system that we operate for state employees, but that they also acknowledge that savings to the system is necessary at this point because of the unfunded mandates, the unfunded liabilities. There seems to be broad agreement that we do not want to create an incentive for an exodus of state employees or PERS-covered workers. That doesn't benefit the functions of the state agencies and certainly won't help us long-term in managing PERS. We all would like to stay out of court. That certainly doesn't benefit any of us. I certainly agree with Senator Minnis's observation that Senator Trill raised, and that is I think we do need to have a dialogue with the PERS board about policy, and we understand that the legislature won't abdicate its prerogative to set policy, nor would the board, I think, abdicate its responsibility for communicating the effect of policy changes. But I think we need a great deal more dialogue about our mutual understanding about how we'll relate to each other, you know, where the policy line and where the prerogatives are, and how we can get more information and better information that will inform policy decisions. When you mentioned that you could not or felt that the agency could not currently adequately manage the system, I expected to be seeing a sweep of reporters like in the old B-30s movies where they all run right to the telephone banks to call in the headlines, you know, director indicates PERS unmanageable. but I think what we're trying to get our arms around in this instance is the Senate bill before us makes a course correction and directs a change, which we all agree, I think, that you have the authority to make under current statute. That's the actuarial table. It also indicates a change in how some of the benefits are calculated. But what appears to be a course correction now begs a whole list of other systemic issues that aren't addressed by this bill. And so what clearly comes from your testimony is that the problems in PERS are systemic, they're longstanding, they're highly complicated issues, and that course corrections may drive a whole stream of unintended consequences. I don't know if Senate Bill 1021 ever had the intention to define the key terms or set the parameters around money match. Or certainly there was no question that you would operate a program that met the IRC requirements and the definitions of a statutorily adequate system. That was never a question about qualified plan status. That is not an option for us since we have to do that. But it's clear that what's intended is to create some savings for employers and some control of benefit costs that are unfunded. So, you know, I'm wondering if we shouldn't really pull together these working groups that have been meeting in every nick and cranny in this building and every hallway since yesterday, and also work with legislative leadership to try to put parameters around what it is that we intend to do in this special session. you know, what I see to be a course correction, which is intended to help with some immediate savings, not create a stampede toward the exits by current employees, not violate the longstanding contractual obligations that we have with employees. I'm hopeful that we can still accomplish those goals and that we can make some course corrections that will be helpful, and in the process inform a bigger discussion, a larger and more far-ranging discussion about how to restructure PERS, or whether we continue the PERS structure as it is, or in fact create another venue for a whole retirement system in Oregon. I'm not sure we'd do that in 6 days in a special legislative session environment.
You can rest on the seventh day.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
None of us are qualified. Senator Fisher has a comment.
Well, a comment and a question. You seem very hesitant to define what policy should be, and yet I see a situation arising that I can kind of apply to a situation where an engineer designs a car and never realizes that somebody can't get an elbow and an arm down in to change the spark plug. Now, you guys are dealing with it, and a mechanic, if somebody's paying any attention to the mechanic's going to tell him, I need a certain amount of space to get down here and get this job done. You've obviously got some ideas, or you ought to have, I would think, without being terribly critical. If you've been there 2 years and you worked with this thing, you ought to have some ideas of how things could be approached to change this, which I haven't worked with it for 2 years. I don't belong to the system. I've never been a retirement specialist or anything like that. I don't figure actuarial tables. I'm up here basically like an engineer that probably never put a wrench on a car in his life, trying to design the car, and I could use some help from the guy out on the where the rubber meets the road. And I don't know how to do that necessarily, but I see this as not just germane to the situation we're facing now. This happens in a lot of government places, and I've talked with people time and time again, say, you know, we got a problem here. Well, I don't. That's not my domain, you know. I only do this. I only follow the rules, or I only do the rules, or one thing and another, you know. And there's no interest in going over and stepping and taking the other mile and doing something about it when you know and you're working with it actively and you know the problem. So I am very interested when you outline problems here and you say that you don't have definitions for this. Well, tell me what a definition ought to be. What are you dealing with? What is your problem? I can say, you know, that a definition of actuarial equivalent is X, Y, Z, and it may not even come close to approaching what your needs are. So how do we break this deadlock between you guys saying you don't want to influence policy and you don't want to tell us what we want to do, and yet we don't know what we need to do?
Chair Farioli, Senator Fisher, it is a dilemma. And the fact of the matter is that we are in a unique position as trustees. We're not like the head of ODOT, for example, who is an advocate for a particular policy of the state and the executive branch on highway policy or transportation policy.
Well, I'm glad you're not.
I have my hands full. And it is a dilemma. It's kind of like two people standing in front of a revolving door. Who goes first? We say you, as the keepers of pension policy, ought to have the right to go first.
We have. We have 1021. Now tell us what's wrong, where we need to go.
Well, what's wrong with it depends on what policy objective you have. It's particularly problematic in the case of PERS because the statute has accumulated over 56 years. Almost none of it has become sunset, so it all remains active. And legislatures over the years have decided, for example, that the truck should be long, or that the car should be short, or it should be wide, or it should be red. And each time they put their particular changes in to try to make it longer or shorter or wider or a different color. And we're now reacting to the cumulative set of desires over decades, all of which, by the way, are statutory instruction to us. I can't impress upon you enough how much time the board pores over the statute and says, what should we do if this part of the statute says we're supposed to do X and that part says we're supposed to do Y? Or it says we're supposed to be actuarial equivalent. What does that mean?
But we have a statutorial start at changing some of this. We need to know where you need to change. If the truck's too blame long to make the curves, we need to know from
it. Well, and if we can start with a premise that says the truck ought to be long, then we can tell you whether or not 1021 gets there. What we are telling you today is that 1021 is closest to immediate implementation. These are the characteristics on the left-hand column that we said to the board and the board accepted matter. Now, they may be additional ones for you, but these matter for us. Notice that what isn't on here is changes in benefit levels or system cost funding levels, which we don't believe are our prerogative. But we did generate information on those because the board needs to know whether or not it's putting the system in peril. And that information can be provided to you as well. The changes range from no change in liabilities to as much as $1.5 billion, so that the numbers are significant.
I'd like to just come to a brief summary of what we have and then ask a different question to possibly take us in a slightly different direction. But what I'm hearing is that this committee has a little more work ahead of it to do to define what the parameters are that we're going to be working with in this legislative session. I think a course correction is needed. We do have some fiscal impact analysis that's been done on the bill as it's drafted. There are folks meeting in a work group process that will be bringing forward possibly one or maybe even two different approaches. What we need to do is work with the board and learn what it feels are the fiscal impacts of these course corrections and changes, work with legislative fiscal to make sure that we have numbers that roughly match, although they may not be identical. And then do the prerogative of the legislature, which is to set the policy and make the fiscal decisions and make sure that that is not disruptive to the operation of this agency. So the bigger implication, and I think the one that we go forward with from the special session, is that PERS needs direction and much more interaction with the legislature. We need to have a better partnership between the legislature and this agency in administering this program, and that involves policy issues and mechanics. So I think that's the bigger job that's ahead of us. There was a work group that was established by the PERS board some time ago, and we heard it alluded to yesterday in testimony several times by different witnesses, and I guess I'd like to hear from your perspective, what was the objective that you had in mind as a board when you asked for this work group to be impaneled, and what were their parameters of consideration, and how far down the road did you get, and did any consensus come out of it, and where were the points of disagreement? I know that's an awful lot, and we'll take that information and you have to put it in.
Chair Ferriolli, I think I can summarize it very quickly. Using advisory groups is our normal practice because we have a number of key stakeholder constituencies. They're very important to the state, both our membership organizations as well as public employers. This was a normal thing to do to create. This is what our board does all the time. And we had many meetings with those stakeholder groups. The objective was to, one, figure out the dimensions of the issue. That is, how big a difference had grown between the old tables and what true life expectancies are today, to establish a set of facts that everybody could agree on. And I believe that we're close to that. I don't know any facts or any significant facts that people differ on. The second is that the board instructed the staff to develop options like the four that you have in front of you today and present them to the stakeholder groups for comment. Those stakeholder groups went through in numerous sessions with us and, in fact, directly with the subcommittee of the board and talked about the objectives that you see along the left-hand side there and their preferences and pluses and minuses as they saw these various options. The two stakeholder groups did not come to a consensus on a particular option that they supported. I believe it's fair to say that a number of employer groups thought that the incremental transitional approach described as the five-year wear-away there was they had favorable comments to say. And our member organizations, the PERS Coalition, felt, in fact, they were largely the authors of the multiple segment approach, although it's very similar to the change in concept that was made by the board in 1998. So that process was extensive. It did, I think, generate a fact base on which most parties agree, and the sort of chart that summarizes options and principles was the one that the stakeholders as well as the board generated most of their discussion and comments to us on. I would hesitate to speak for them because I think they're perfectly capable of speaking for themselves. So I think that Mr. DeLashmet yesterday did an excellent job in presenting sort of his sense of what went on, and I wouldn't take great issue with that. I really, with respect to saying what stakeholders feel or groups of stakeholders feel, I would like to defer to their characterization as opposed to mine.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. They did an excellent job yesterday, and it appears to me that the working group that was convened did provide a good basis for discussion. And I think all the groups acknowledge that they've moved beyond where those talks were at the time that they came to closure for the board. So I'm glad to see that that effort is benefiting this process, and it seems to be ongoing. And if this bill is the catalyst for that discussion, so much the better.
Here, Fairy Ollie, I think even if the legislature chooses not to act, my understanding is the board feels the need to put in place a mortality table policy for actuarial equivalency factors and would continue to work with the stakeholders and come to a conclusion. I can only say that the board chair has said in public meetings that it would be good for members as well as for employer stakeholders to get resolution of this issue. It's just not an easy one. And as you pointed out, everything that takes place in the PERS system has extraordinarily high potential for unintended consequences somewhere else in those 64,000 words that we don't anticipate now. But it only takes one of our 294,000 members to bring litigation, or one of our 867 employers. I would say this about litigation, that through experience and practicality, we always assume that anything that we do, even of a minor nature, has the potential for being litigated, because any one of our 294,000 members can feel aggrieved and take issue. We have litigation of that nature with a single member on consequential issues going on as we speak. Or even the employer-led litigation that it is occurring in the courthouse down the street is really only brought by a handful of our 867 employers. So we assume that there are no guarantees. In fact, there can be no guarantee that there won't be litigation no matter what we do.
Well, I guess the issue for us is to decide whether or not we'll let that possibility prevent us from taking action that's clearly needed. And I would hope that we don't get into a situation where, as in our natural resource management, anyone with a 35-cent stamp and an appeal template from a word processor can stop an action. We understand that everything can be litigated. Every action that we take is potentially at someone's expense. We'll do everything I think that we can with policy decisions to keep you out of the impact area as much as possible, but there may always be an aggrieved party. And that's why you have attorneys on staff, and that's why we have the AG, et cetera. But we won't intentionally put you in harm's way. But I don't think that the threat of being in harm's way should deter us from trying to take needful action. Colleagues, if we have no further discussion or questions, I really appreciate the testimony and the time that every person in connected with Senate Bill 1021 has brought to us.
Well, the comment I would have
is
that the thing that I see is you can fool around with this thing and let it go to where it gets out of hand, and the state is not above bankruptcy, as New York City and some of the other places have found out there. There are ends of these things, whether we like it or not, and litigation can fly by the boards when it gets to the point where there isn't any money to pay for it. And so I do think it behooves to get started on something and avoid that consequence ultimately, which isn't going to do anybody any good.
Other comments?
If we ever run out of money, the statute requires
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
you, Chair.
My colleagues, the process that we have informally engaged in is a working group process.
That on the balance,
it seems like the organization is self-selecting its members, and that process will continue. This bill will stay with the committee. Clearly, there is some interest in additional amendment to the bill. We'll be presenting those and post as necessary. Senator Fair has a question.
I just wanted to say that I understand that the employer group and the employee groups have been talking to each other, and I hope they'll continue that and see if we can't get some agreement among those as to where we might proceed with this, because something needs to be done. You're all involved with the issue and know a lot about it, and it'd be nice to see if you could come up with something that you agree to.
Because of this, the interest in this bill and the interest in this issue, we're not going to adjourn. We're just going to recess this hearing, and we'll call it again when we have further information from these informal working groups. And I would urge you to contact the House and Senate Majority Offices, the House and Senate Minority Offices, the President's Office, the Speaker's Office, and other members of the leadership team and members of this committee. And when we feel that there is enough movement toward consensus, we'll reconvene and have presentation. So we will recess this committee hearing. Colleagues, before we adjourn today, yesterday we took action.